Good evening. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host for A Novel Idea. Tonight, we're bringing you an encore presentation of Christina Sunley and her novel, The Tricking of Freya. Christina is currently on a book tour in Iceland, and you can follow her on Facebook. The Tricking of Freya has just been issued in paperback. And here she is, Christina Sunley.
You want a bit of birdie? Try this, a June afternoon, early 1970s on the beach at Gimli. Birdie, in a skirted turquoise swimsuit and cat-eye sunglasses, lounging legs crossed at the ankles on her aluminum chaise. Just past 40 and still glamorous, on her good days. Not a movie star, but a kind of star you don't have a name for. You're just past 8 and far from glamorous. Birdie compares you, kindly, to an egret as you stride the beach, your legs long and skinny as stilts, your wispy white blonde hair tufting in the wind, your eyes a blue so light they startle. See? Birdie is dangling something in her hand, something small and glistening, jewel-like. You've played this game before. She's going to throw it, and you're going to catch it, by mouth. You stand a few feet from the edge of the blanket, bare toes clenching sand, arms swinging restlessly at your sides. Your eyes fix on the prize. One, Birdie teases. Two. Come on, you shriek. Three. Birdie tosses the thing in the air. It's a single mandarin orange segment, straight from the tin. You're a dog, no, a seal, a trained dolphin, leaping up, snapping your jaw, swallowing the slippery minnow whole. Orange syrup dribbles down your chin. You smack your lips in citrus triumph. Birdie claps and laughs. Bravo, Elskan, bravo. Elskan means love in Icelandic, like honey or deer. Birdie always calls you Elskan, then tosses you another mandarin fish.
Good evening and welcome to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. You've been listening to a reading by Christina Sunley from her new book, The Tricking of Freya. And obviously, Christina is here in the studio with me. She lives in the Bay Area, and we're going to spend the time discussing her new book. Welcome, Christina.
Thank you so much, Rosemary.
Yeah. I'd like to ask you a trite question, but I'm always interested in this. Have you always been a writer?
Yes, from the very beginning. In fact, before I knew how to write, my mother would write my poems down for me, some of which I still have.
So you were a writer before you could write.
I was a writer before I could write.
I guess the answer to that question then is yes.
It's an absolute yes. I always wrote all through school, poetry and stories. But that doesn't always mean that I had a conception of myself as a writer in the world.
Yes, that's different.
But it was certainly something that I loved to do from the very earliest.
Mm-hmm. And this is your first novel?
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And it's from St. Martin's Press, and it's already available at the bookstores. The name of it is The Tricking of Freya, and I'm sure by the end of this hour, our listeners will be on their way to their favorite independent bookstore to get their hands on a copy of this book.
I certainly hope so.
It's a great read. I enjoyed this book a great deal. When you read the beginning of the book, when I read it for the first time, the book is written in the first person, in the person of Freya, your protagonist. And I was so interested that you're addressing the reader as you. Now, that's very effective, but also not easy to do. I first thought of Marilynne Robinson in Gilead, where she opens, "I told you last night that I might be gone sometime," and how that just grabs the reader. And the same thing here. Talk a little bit about addressing the reader as you.
she's not addressing the reader of the book. She's addressing her long-lost cousin, who may or may not exist, who she's attempting to track down. And she speaks to her directly as you and develops this kind of intimate narrative relationship with her.
Well, it's very effective because I came to feel to be the person that Freya was looking for. So it's a hook that really, really works. Yes. And when we first meet Freya, she's speaking as an adult. And then before long, we meet Freya, the young girl. So Freya, as an adult, is on her quest to find a missing person.
Yes. She finds out, she stumbles across a family secret that her favorite aunt, who was a troubled but extremely compelling person in her life, may have had a child out of wedlock or out of marriage who had been given up for adoption. And now that Freya is really on her own in the world, she's turning 30 and she really has no living relatives left except an elderly grandmother who's senile, she decides that she wants to find out if her Aunt Bertie really did have a child. And if she did, she wants to find that child and transmit the whole family history, the family memory, the family experiences that that child had never had. Mm-hmm. And so the book is really the form of a letter almost to that lost cousin who she feels somehow that finding her is somehow going to redeem Freya herself.
And Freya is the last of the line as far as she knows, so it's very important. I learned from reading this book how important family is to Icelandic people. They call the Icelandic people our people. And so it's particularly important for her to locate this cousin and get to know her.
You know, I think family, of course, is important to all of us as humans, but the Icelanders take it to another level because they're extremely interested in genealogy and family connections and keeping track of people. And as you read the book, you discover that Freya's grandmother, Sigga, is the family genealogist, and she has a blue book filled with the genealogy of their family. But that comes from the Icelanders themselves. They are still very, very fanatic about genealogy, and now that everything's on the internet, it's pretty amazing. I've been getting emails from people in Iceland sending me their genealogies and trying to figure out how we're related. And so for people to have a gap in their family tree is a kind of serious thing to many Icelanders. And so there are many Icelanders who come to Canada and the United States to try to track down their family lines of people who may have immigrated here, as well as people from North America going back to Iceland. Mm-hmm. But one of the most amazing experiences that I had on my first trip to Iceland was when a relative put my name into his genealogy database, and he traced me back 1,000 years, generation by generation, without missing a single link, all the way back to my most favorite saga character, a Viking poet, which was very thrilling. And then he printed it out for me, and I still have it. So this is really the largest, longest, most intact genealogical database of any country in the world, as far as I know.
What an amazing story. That must have been a thrilling moment.
It was really amazing, and I think part of why I was able to get so connected to all this family history is because my relatives had done such a good job of keeping track of everything. And once my mother finally succeeded in getting me interested in the family history, which took a while, there was so much to give me and there was so much to feed my imagination. I mean, there were memoirs and there were diaries and there were letters and there were genealogies. And a lot of families don't have that kind of history preserved. And one of my missions in life is to really encourage people to save their family histories, to write their life stories, because it creates an incredible legacy for your descendants in the future who may discover things and have their whole lives change, as I have.
As you have, yes. There's such a sense of place in this novel that Iceland is almost a character in the novel. Did you always know about the family in Iceland and your roots there? And then as an adult, you got interested in it? Or how did that happen?
Well, when I was growing up, my mother told me a lot of family stories. I grew up in New York. She had grown up in Winnipeg, Canada, where a lot of the Icelanders had settled. And her parents' families had both come from Iceland. And she had many, many memories of living in this Icelandic enclave in Winnipeg. And so I grew up hearing stories all the time about these people as if they were just down the block from us. You know, Siggy this and the Finn Bogason boys did that. And then, of course, she would talk about Iceland itself. Her father had immigrated when he was 6 years old. And he had written a brief memoir and, of course, had told her stories of what he remembered. There had been a very devastating volcanic eruption, and that is one of the things that triggered a mass exodus from Iceland. And he was 5 years old at the time of that eruption. And so that was a story that she often told me as a child.
Yes. And the mythology of Iceland is extremely important. I reached all the way back to my college days and remembered reading some of the Icelandic Eddas, which I understand are either prose or poetry. And I even found my world literature text and hauled it out and brought it in. And it has very little about it in it, about the Eddas, mostly devoted to the Greeks and what we got from them. But a nice little piece. And as I read it, it reminded me of Beowulf.
Absolutely, because Icelandic is very close to Old Norse, and Old Norse and Old English were fairly closely connected.
Yes.
In the meantime, English has evolved and changed a great deal and incorporated a lot of words from many other languages, French and Latin and so on. We're kind of a mutt language, and we attract a lot of different words from all over the world. So our modern English is very different from the Old English, the Anglo-Saxon. But modern Icelandic is not very different from Old Norse. And they can actually read the medieval sagas written in Old Norse fairly easily.
And it's very important to them to not change their language. Am I correct?
Yes. What happened was the other Scandinavian languages all kind of simplified over time because there were a lot of people going back and forth in those countries in Norway and Sweden and Denmark. But Iceland was very isolated from the world for about 800 years. And really the only people speaking Icelandic were the Icelanders. And the language just didn't change very much. So it has a very kind of complex, arcane grammar that makes it quite difficult for an outsider to learn the language. But they also feel that it's a vital part of their heritage. And once they came out from this colonial rule that they were under for so many centuries, they really took hold of their language again. And now if any foreign words need to come into the language, like when new things get invented, technology, television, or computer, instead of letting an English word come into the language or another foreign word, they make up their own Icelandic equivalent.
Yeah, and you have an illustration of that in your book where someone is working on translating them into a thing, and they translated television and the computer.
Yeah, the word for computer that they came up with, there's a committee that actually comes up with these words. And a distant cousin of mine, I believe, is actually on this Icelandic language committee. And what they try to do is to take old words that have fallen out of disuse, archaic words, and recycle them for these new technological words.
Uh-huh.
And one great example of that is the word for computer monitor, which is skjáir. And skjáir means literally the embryonic sac of a lamb. And in olden times, when they lived in these turf-roofed earthen homes, they didn't have glass. And so they used this embryonic sac, the membrane, as a window covering to look through. Well, eventually, like everybody else, they got glass. And so that word fell out of use. And when they were looking for the word to come up with in Icelandic for computer monitor, they decided to recycle that word, skjaur.
And you're, are you fluent in Icelandic?
Oh, I am so unfluent in Icelandic,
okay.
Rosemary.
But you can get along in Icelandic.
I can get along. I'm a bit rusty because I haven't been there in a while.
Yes.
But I did find that the grammar was absolutely maddening. And very, very difficult to learn. My pronunciation was pretty good, and people could understand me, and I could understand them. But every part of speech can have just – it seems like an infinite number of variations. It's not really infinite, but I once figured out that there are 144 variations on the word the alone. And even a person's name changes. So your name would be different depending on whether I said – Rosemary is reading a book, or I gave the book to Rosemary.
Oh, my goodness gracious. And they are the most literate people in the world. They have the highest degree of literacy, the highest book production per capita. What amazing people. They love readers and writers.
They do. And it's a very strong part of the Icelandic heritage. And that partly has to do with the fact that for so long they were an impoverished nation, cut off from the world. And they really didn't have a lot. They didn't have the materials to create a lot of art or sculpture or architecture or even music. Mm-hmm. And so what they had was their literature, their stories, and their mm-hmm. poetry. And that really became the core of the culture. Of course, now, you know, there's more Icelanders on the internet per capita than anywhere else. But one thing you have to keep in mind with all these Icelandic per capita statistics is there's only 300,000 people in the whole country.
That's right. And also they have a long winter. I want to read a paragraph from your book. This is on page 64. Winter in Iceland, Freya Min, this is Birdie speaking, was much longer and darker than here. Little work could be done outdoors. Light was scant. The weather forbidding. Dark day after long dark day, the Icelanders were trapped inside. How did they stand it? They read. Members of the household took turns reading out loud by the smoky glow of a lamp lit by whale oil, sagas and poetry and the Bible and newspapers and any books they could get their hands on. Books were passed from farm to farm. The name for these evening readings was Kvöldvar. You say it.
Kvöldvaka.
Oh, it's beautiful. Meaning evening wake. In Iceland, in winter, words took the place of light. What a beautiful sentence and what a beautiful concept. Words taking the place of light.
And I think words can be very sustaining for people.
Yes.
And stories. And I hope that we don't lose that. With all the variations we have now for media and communication, I feel somehow that story still needs to be at the center of the culture.
Yes, yes. And a great deal of memorization takes place. Originally, the stories were told, not written. And so the memorization is highly prized. And at one point, your protagonist, Freya, learns a great deal of Icelandic and learns a long poem and gets a chance to show off with that.
Yes. One of the things that amazed me when I first went to Iceland, my great-great-uncle, well, two of my great-great-uncles were well-known poets, but one was especially beloved in the east of Iceland. He was what was known as a farmer poet. His name was Palt Olafsson. And well, when I was traveling in the east of Iceland, people, of course, wanted to know who I was and who my people were. And so I would tell them, and they would find out that I was related to Palt Olafsson. And, you know, there were so many people, farmers, who would just recite his poetry from memory to me. I remember sitting in a barn with a farmer at a farm bed and breakfast where I was staying, and he was milking the cows and he was reciting the poetry of my great-great-uncle from heart.
You know, I'm just overwhelmed to hear these stories of your experiences among your people.
Yeah, well, one of the things that was interesting as well is when I went to the rural parts of Manitoba where the Icelanders had settled, I met some elderly farmers there, and they too were able to recite that poetry by heart, so in Icelandic. And so a lot of that tradition has continued on among those of us of Icelandic descent.
Mm-hmm. Even with the internet and all of that, they're still memorizing the sagas and the
poetry.
Well,
I think the older people.
Yes.
I think that, of course, has changed and is dying out.
Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah.
Well, to get back to your story, Freya is your protagonist, is named for a goddess. There must have been a story behind how you selected that name for your protagonist.
Well, I got very interested in Norse mythology, and there aren't a lot of goddesses that are well known in Norse mythology. Freya mm-hmm. is really the main one. It's a pretty male-dominated mythology, at least as it's been passed down to us. Mm-hmm. But I found Freya very interesting. She's mm-hmm. Considered a fertility goddess, a goddess of love. But she's also the goddess who has this almost shamanic power or ability to go into a trance and to see into the future. So she has the art of prophecy. And it's said about Freya that she taught Odin, the great father, sky god, the art of prophecy.
Mm-hmm. Well, Freya the child is we start with Freya the adult, and then we get the backstory of Freya the child. She's really a remarkable character. I just love the character of this little girl, so bright, so interested in everything, and independent, and often getting into trouble because of her independence. And her mother, Anna, is a fairly calm person, but her aunt Birdie, then, with whom she spends the summer up in Gimli, brings this whole aspect of the Icelandic culture, for one thing, but Birdie's liveliness is so appealing to Freya.
I think she feels a real connection to Birdie because mm-hmm. Birdie's very impulsive, and so is Freya. Mm-hmm. They both love language, and so they have these things in common with each other, and it creates a real spark between them.
Yes, and of course it means a great deal to Birdie that Freya is so fascinated with the Icelandic language and wants to hear the stories.
Birdie makes sure that Freya hears the stories because Birdie's father, Freya's grandfather, was the most famous poet of New Iceland that's what the community was called there. He was the most famous poet of the Icelandic immigrants. Mm-hmm. And so she believes that it's imperative that little American Freya from the suburbs of Connecticut learn this whole legacy about her grandfather, who was a great poet. Mm-hmm.
Did we talk about how they happened to emigrate because of the volcanic eruption?
I touched on that briefly.
Yeah, you might say a little more about that.
But what happened was the eruption was in the east of Iceland, and it devastated a lot of the farmland. Conditions were already pretty terrible at the time there. And they had been scouting out an area for Icelanders to settle in North America. And a group of Icelanders went and they got a land grant from the Canadian government on Lake Winnipeg, and they called it New Iceland. And by the time the volcano erupted, they were just charting out this territory, and then suddenly thousands of Icelanders arrived there. And my grandfather was one of them as a child. And like many immigrants here, they went through a very tough time at first. They were completely unprepared for Manitoba. First of all, although you might not believe it, it was much, much colder than Iceland. Mm-hmm. Also, they had never really grown things other than hay because you really can't grow produce in Iceland. So they didn't know how to farm, and the men didn't even know how to use an axe to cut down trees because there are no trees in Iceland. They didn't know how to do lake fishing. They only knew how to do sea fishing. And so, of course, there were a lot of problems. They had a smallpox epidemic. They had terrible flooding. And my grandfather wrote about all of this in his memoir. And it was really reading that memoir that got me so interested in the family history.
So you had the stories.
Oh, I did. Yes. I heard a lot of these stories from my mother when I was growing up.
And then you created this wonderful character and placed her in the middle of the story.
I think part of it was that I didn't actually know my grandparents. They died long before I was born. My mother was orphaned. And she only had one sister, and they were estranged their whole adult lives. And my father was an only child. So the result was that I grew up without any grandparents, aunts, uncles, or cousins. And I feel that in a way in this book I invented this whole extended family that I never had.
Mm-hmm. So Freya and her mother go every summer up to Winnipeg and up to the lake, up to Gimli, where New Iceland is flourishing. And Freya really looks forward to that. That's the high point of her life, is going up there with all the family. And then when she's... is it 6 years old when the accident takes place?
She's seven.
I'm going to let our readers find out for themselves what the accident actually is, because it's so beautifully written, and one should come up to it without knowing exactly what's going to happen. But there is an accident, and Freya's mother faints and hurts her head and is hospitalized.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Freya feels responsible, guilty, and shamed. Yeah. And then she's left at home with Birdie to take care of her, while Grandma Sigga goes to the hospital to take care of Anna. I thought it was so amusing that when Freya heard that her mother was in a coma, she heard it as a comma, and she pictured her mother curled up like a comma through the whole thing. Her misunderstandings of words are so amusing, and there are many of them in the book.
Yeah, she was really quite terrified that her mother might die or might never wake up again, and she had this huge sense of responsibility for her mother that I think became kind of a shadow over her childhood.
Yeah.
But then her times with Birdie made her feel more free. That's when Birdie was in a good mood, of course.
Yes.
Birdie is a very moody character, and she has some very bad moods, too, that were quite hard on Freya.
Yes. And in a sense, Freya's mother, Anna, really never did recover fully. She was always frail, walked with a cane. And back in Connecticut, Freya felt she was obliged to take care of her mother. And it changed her personality completely. She was no longer the bright, charming, show-offy little girl that she'd been before.
And I think when she – it's very true that incident and the repercussions of that incident, as well as further things that happen in the book with Birdie, really caused Freya to shut down and to – really close off her core personality, who she really is, that lively, bright, poetic child. And I think that in her quest to find Birdie's child, who was given up in this closed adoption, in this quest, she starts to recover her old self as well.
Mm-hmm. And Birdie is not a responsible caretaker. Birdie takes Freya to the beach during the time when her mother is in the hospital, and doesn't pay any attention to shielding her from the sun. And Freya gets a terrible sunburn, which can be really very dangerous. And Grandma Sigga is just horrified that Birdie would be so irresponsible.
But not surprised.
No.
That was just the beginning of one of many things. Many tragedies in which Birdie and Freya were intertwined. And I do think that because they both have impulsive personalities, mm-hmm. it meant that when the two of them were together unsupervised, a lot of chaos could result.
And the two of them together unsupervised, something really amazing takes place. As Freya said, Birdie and I set off for Iceland. And Birdie had prepared that in advance, but Freya had no knowledge of it. Tell us how that came about being at the festival and all of that.
Well, Birdie had always wanted to take Freya to Iceland. But, of course, the family was frugal and felt that there wasn't money for this kind of trip. And so Birdie plans it on her own. I mean, Birdie is – one thing to really say about Birdie is she's a person with bipolar disorder, or what's called manic depression. And one of the symptoms of that illness can be this kind of irrational spending of money and irrational behavior when somebody's in a very manic stage. And that was the case with Birdie. She planned this trip to take Freya, and she told Freya that everyone in the family knew about it, and it was a great surprise that she was going to take her to Iceland. But in reality, Birdie just really kidnapped Freya and took her off to Iceland.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, you use that in your text just before Freya says, and Birdie took me to Iceland. So we realize that it was literally a kidnapping.
Yes, although Freya doesn't know while she's in Iceland that her mother and her grandmother and everyone are frantically searching for them. And of course, have no idea that they would be in Iceland.
Mm-hmm.
They think perhaps that they've maybe drowned in Lake Winnipeg,
that's
or
right.
that who knows where Birdie has taken her. They really had no idea.
They were frantic.
They were very frantic.
Meanwhile, in Iceland, Freya is discovering Iceland. Much, much more to talk about. But right now, we'll take a short break. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host for A Novel Idea. My guest is Christina Sunley, and the book is The Tricking of Freya. We'll be right back.
I walked all morning to lift my heart.
Rosemary Manchester, your host for A Novel Idea, and I'm here in the studio with Christina Sundley to discuss her book, The Tricking of Freya. And would you read the first part of chapter 15? It's on page 122, when Freya is writing about her introduction to Iceland.
Nothing, not even Birdie's magical spiel on the airplane, could have prepared me for what lay beyond Reykjavik. Iceland is land alive, the earth split open, forming and reforming before your eyes. Vast vistas of swirling black and neon green moss-drenched lavascapes. Volcanoes in all directions and at every stage of existence, smoldering, dormant, extinct. Glaciers on the move, their hoary tongues licking the edges of meadows. Water falling everywhere, trickling, spilling, clamoring, rumbling down rocky crevices and canyons, and spitting up boiling hot from holes in the ground. Meandering through this riot of lava and ice and emerald slopes, as if it were the most ordinary scenery in the world, wild horses, stout-bellied and thick-maned, peering out from behind fringed bangs. And the ubiquitous sheep with their spiraling horns and shaggy dreadlocked coats. We're outnumbered, Birdie would say when we'd round a bend and confront six sheep napping in the roadway. By this she meant the fact that there are more sheep than people in Iceland. Far more. Everywhere you go, it's sheep agraze, munching grass on top of turf-roofed ruins, nipping at odd bits of growth in barren lava fields, hoofing it up the rocky bank of a waterfall. We let them roam free, Ulver explained, and this is why they taste so good. The lava moss gives them a particular flavor, so we give our sheep the run of the island. I wanted the run of the island. I'd never seen nature so wild. I was used to the timid rolling hills of Connecticut, the flat, scrubby shore of Lake Winnipeg, forests. In Iceland, there are no trees to speak of. Trees get in the way, Ulver explained. They block the view. Trees can't grow in Iceland. That's the truth of it. Little does. But I could grow there. I felt myself expanding. For the first time since Mama's accident, I had no dutiful routines, no canes to keep track of, no Mama to tend. It freed and it terrified. I began wearing my hair pulled back. The wind made me do it. In Iceland, it never stops blowing, and at first I felt barefaced. Then Birdie touched her fingertips to my cheekbones. "You're a beauty," she told me. "Me? A beauty?" I shook my head laughing, but during those days at Ulver's summer house, I allowed myself to believe it, or at least to consider the possibility. The landscape itself emboldened me. I spoke up more, dropped my shield of shyness and silence. I began to speak only Icelandic, then to think and even dream in it.
We should probably tell our listeners who Ulver is. Did I say it? Well, you pronounce it.
Yeah. Ulver is a family friend. He's a friend of Birdie's. Birdie has made many trips to Iceland. The Icelanders are great fans of her father's poetry, and so is the daughter of the famous poet. She's made several tours of Iceland. And Ulver is a scholar in Iceland who's particularly interested in her work. Mm-hmm. And so when Freya and Birdie go to Iceland, it's Ulver who picks them up at the airport, and Ulver and his son, Sæmundur, who take them around.
Yeah. And I want to read the paragraph about Ulver's house. "That house was the most marvelous thing I have ever seen, not from the outside. From the outside, it was a three-story cement facade painted pastel green. But the inside, books lined every wall of every room. Books climbed up stairs and rested on landings. Books stretched over the arches of doorways like bridges, stood guard over mantels. Old leather-bound volumes with gilt titles gleamed in glass cabinets. Books in the basement, books in the attic, four stories of books. How many, I wanted to know. 9,600, Ulver answered. Approximately. The largest private book collection in Iceland."
Well, that was based actually on a distant cousin of mine who I went to visit and really knew nothing about. He was very elderly at the time, and I arrived at his house on the lake in Reykjavik, and it was just unbelievable because I didn't even know that he was a book collector. And I walked in, and it was just floor after floor after floor of books. And it was kind of the epitome of the Icelandic interest in books, because in all the houses that I went to in Iceland and all the farmhouses, books were always very prominent. But he had copies, you know, the first printed copies of the sagas and the first Bibles that had been printed, and he had collected everything.
Mm-hmm. And he was critical of the new writing. He was a classicist, and she so wanted his approval. And she didn't really get his approval of her work because it was so modern.
Birdie was more of an experimental modernist kind of writer, mm-hmm. poet, and Ulver had a very traditional view of things. He was a saga scholar, mm-hmm. and so he didn't really approve of her work, although it's hard to know how much he really disapproved of it, because we only hear about his reaction from Birdie, who tends to exaggerate things.
That's true. But it was enough for Birdie to want to take off on her own. And so she and Freya set off in Ulver's Jeep to find the volcano, the original scene of the eruption which sent the family to Canada.
Well, that is in Birdie's mind, but that's not what she tells Freya that they're doing.
That's right.
She says that they're looking for the lost letters.
Right, the lost letters.
Of Freya's grandfather, the poet.
Yes.
And Birdie has become increasingly paranoid and believes that perhaps Ulver is even in on a plot to prevent her from finding the letters, or that he may even have the letters, which would be of great historic value, and that he wants to get the credit himself. So they take off on this journey, but looking for the letters, but they do end up at that volcano, which is a very treacherous place to be.
They're far off the road. They should not be there at all. It's a very thrilling and dangerous journey that they're on. And that's about all we're going to tell our readers, because they should make that journey with Birdie and Freya for themselves. We don't want to take away the pleasure of the suspense, and neither do we want to tell them the outcome. And the book is just full of surprises.
This passage is from the part of the book where Freya is a child and she's visiting her Aunt Bertie in Gimli in the summer. If it's hot at night and the mosquitoes keep buzzing you awake, you can knock on Bertie's door, and sometimes she'll let you in. And you can lie in your white cotton nightie on Bertie's four-poster bed, watching her fingers dance along the typewriter keys like your mother playing piano. Except it's a different kind of music, typing, like a rainstorm or hail. Bertie's been working on the same poem forever, one poem, years long. What's it called? It changes. At the moment, I'm calling it Word Meadow. You smother a giggle with your hand. Bertie could get mad if you laugh, but she doesn't. Word Meadow is a kenning for tongue, she explains. And I suppose now you'll want to know what a kenning is. She sits beside you on the bed and rubs your head like a pup's. A kenning is a different name for a thing. Instead of calling the sun, you can call it a day star. Why not use its real name? It's boring, that's why. The old poets were never content with just one or two words for a thing. Masters of periphrastic trickery, magicians of poetic circumlocution, tossing kennings right and left. Bertie's speeding up, the pupils of her eyes widening black saucers, shiny as record vinyl. You're older now, nearly 11, but even if you lived to be 100, you'd never keep up with Bertie, not when she's revving, buzzing, humming words. Kennings were a way for poets to show off, verbal razzmatazz of the Vikings. A fierce warrior poet, like our infamous forebear, Eilt Skaltagrimsson, could choose from over 100 kennings for the word sword alone. Bertie shakes her curled head in wonderment. A marvel how those Vikings loved their swords. Problem is, 1,000 years later, the poems don't make sense, because most of the kennings reference Norse mythology, and who remembers the old myths anymore? A common kenning for poetry was Odin's mead, but if you don't know the story of how Odin tricked the giants out of their mead so he could imbibe the gift of verse, you'd be utterly lost any time a poem made reference to the Allfather's malt serf or the raven god's holy drink. That's why our ancestor Snorri Sturluson wrote down all the Norse myths in the 12th century, so that Iceland's new Christian poets would understand what the kennings meant. Without Snorri, those myths would be lost to us for eternity. Bertie pauses for the barest fraction of a second. She is pacing now, back and forth in front of the window in nothing but her pink teddy. It doesn't matter. There is no one to peer in and see her. At 2 a.m., all Gimli sleeps, save you and Bertie. Her words swirl your mind, a vast Milky Way of glittery word stars, most of it far beyond your grasp. But you're used to that, to being drawn into word spells that riff like the jazz music she plays on her phonograph late at night. But sped up, 78 RPM, talking faster than the speed of light. Getting talky, your mother calls it. Bertie's getting talky. Sometimes Bertie gets so talky she stops making sense. That's when your mother says, Bertie's going over. Over what? But not tonight. You hear logic in Bertie's voice, even if you can't follow it. Tell me one of the kennings for sword. One of the what? The kennings for sword. You said there were 100. Let's see. There's striker, and lying striker, and life quencher, and windbright. And some really gory ones. You wouldn't want to hear those. You would. Okay, then. Leg biter, pain waiter. Corpse pain, skull crusher, terrifier, pale maker, nightbringer. And then there are the bloody ones. Too bloody for you. No, they're not. Don't tell your mother. I won't. Bertie whispers, blood band, blood warp, blood eddy, blood waker, blood grip. And here's a kenning for tongue, sword of speech. And word meadow, you add. That's the other one for tongue, like the name of your poem. Is it a meadow because words sprout on your tongue like flowers? On a good day, Bertie says. On the good days, they do.
You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is your host, Rosemary Manchester, and I'm talking with Christina Sunley about her book, The Tricking of Freya, which takes us to Iceland. And it seems to me that the magic of the sagas permeates this book. I mean, it's a book with overtones. It resonates to the old stories, to the sagas, and to the long lost days that are portrayed in the Edda and the sagas.
Yeah, even back to the pagan times. And that's
right.
The thing that just I most marveled at when I went to Iceland. It felt, you know, the island has been inhabited for just over 1,000 years, and it was settled in 874. And they've kept track of everything on this island, and they've kept track of all the people and all the stories and all the ghosts and all the elves and all the people from the sagas, most of whom are actual historic characters, real people. And as you drive around the countryside being toured by some Icelandic relative or tour bus driver, they're pointing things out from over 1,000 years of history. You know, here's where this happened from a saga, and here's where something happened in the 17th century and two children drowned and disappeared. And, you know, this history is just alive everywhere you go. Oh, that's a troll mountain up there. Every place in the landscape seems to, every rock and waterfall seems to have some legend or story associated with it.
And they have so little of the land to work with that 90% of Iceland is uninhabitable?
Completely uninhabitable. In fact, I just read that only 0.07% of the land is actually arable.
And you say all they can raise is hay.
Well, the Icelanders are ingenious. And one thing that they have learned how to do is to harness the energy of their geothermal island. And they use that energy not only to heat their homes and to power things, but they also have these geothermal hothouses where they now grow vegetables and produce.
Wouldn't it be great if we had geothermal energy like that? That would make life quite different.
It's a way that Iceland is really trying to model for the rest of the world some of the techniques that they are using. We do have some geothermal energy around here, I think, even
well,
in Sonoma
right.
County.
That's right. We do. I forgot about that. You're touring with this book. Wherever you go, do you meet people from Iceland?
Well, I definitely met people from Iceland, but more than that, I meet people of Icelandic descent.
Ah.
And there are not that many of us. When the immigration happened at the end of the 19th century, about 20,000 Icelanders immigrated. So it's a very small amount when you compare it to the millions and millions of Irish and English and other ethnic groups that have come to this country and are certainly continuing to come to North America. So there were only 20,000 all told that immigrated. And so when I was growing up, for example, I never met a single person of Icelandic descent. Mm-hmm. But now through the internet, we're getting very connected and people are finding out about my readings. And so I've had people show up at my readings of Icelandic descent who are just so thrilled to find their stories in my book.
Oh, that must be very exciting.
It's really incredible. And some of the emails that I've gotten have really just brought tears to my eyes. People who are connected to me in some way, trying to figure out how we're related. One woman I've been corresponding with that I met on Facebook lives in Vancouver but grew up in Winnipeg. And she said, well, I really have to get you connected to my Auntie Agnes in Winnipeg because she knows that I'm on my way to Winnipeg soon for my book tour. So I wrote an email to 89-year-old Auntie Agnes, and I explained who I was. Well, she wrote back and said, of course I know who you are. Your grandfather delivered me and my 13 siblings. Because my grandfather, the one who had immigrated after the volcanic eruption, had become an obstetrician. And so she felt very connected to my family. And her niece had told me that Agnes wrote stories about growing up in this New Iceland area in Gimli and Winnipeg, and she had published them. So I wrote back and I said, well, I hear you're a writer as well. And she wrote back to me and she said, I'm not a writer. I'm just an old dame who tells stories. But her stories are wonderful. She has sent me a package of them and I love them, and I'm going to be meeting her and a number of other relatives that I've never met when I get to Winnipeg.
Is Gimli a real place?
Gimli is a real place.
Oh.
It's also – it is a mythological name. It comes from the poetic Eddas from the Norse mythology. When Ragnarok comes, the end of the world comes, and there's all this chaos, and the earth sinks into the sea, and the sky turns black, and everything's on fire. Then the earth rises again, and there's this paradise called Gimli, where the gods live. And so when the Icelanders were immigrating to North America after the volcanic eruption, they decided to name the capital of their colony Gimli. My mother used to go there as a child, and I've been there. I think it has a population of about 6,000 people year-round. Mm-hmm. It explodes in the summer when they have the annual Icelandic festival, because people of Icelandic descent come from all over, including Iceland, to participate in that.
And I was thinking, as you were talking about Gimli, that when the volcano erupted, they must have thought that was Ragnarok.
The character in my book, the young poet Oliver, Freya's grandfather, he does think that because he's been memorizing that poem. Of course, these people are Christians and have really long ago left behind their mythology, although they're probably much more familiar with it in many ways and more in touch with it than we might be with ours.
And they're probably much more familiar with volcanoes going off than we are. I mean, with so many volcanoes.
There are so many volcanoes on the island and so many glaciers. It's really got to be one of the strangest places on the planet. In fact, that same volcano that erupted in 1875 also erupted, I believe, in 1961, and then they used that as the training ground for the astronauts for the first moonwalk, because they felt it was the most lunar place on Earth.
And the tectonic plates meet in the middle of Iceland.
Yeah, there's two tectonic plates that meet right in the middle of Iceland, and so there's hot volcanic matter coming up between them, pushing the plates apart and actually expanding the size of Iceland. And I feel a connection to that because one of those plates touches up against California here.
That's right. It's hard to get away from the movements of the earth. Right?
It is. Right. It is. But Iceland is a very dramatic place, and they've had a lot of terrible natural disasters over time.
Yes.
The population has almost died out entirely. I mean, at one point, I think in the 17th century, they were down to 37,000 people. Oh. They'd had terrible plagues. And but they survived it all. And as I'm in communication with my friends now in Iceland, where they've just experienced this terrible economic crash, I have a lot of hope that they're going to survive that as well, because I look back over their 1,000 years of history and I feel like this can't be the worst thing that has happened to Iceland.
No, they've been through worse, right? I wanted to mention John McPhee's book, The Control of Nature, which has a very interesting chapter in there on the volcanoes in Iceland. And people might want to take a look at that to get another description of volcanic eruptions and the way the Icelanders respond to that sort of threat.
Oh, there are some wonderful stories about that. And I personally feel like my whole fate really was determined by that volcanic eruption.
Yes.
And so I feel very tied to the volcanoes of Iceland, because if it weren't for them, I wouldn't be here now.
Yeah.
I'd be somewhere else
and
someone else.
We should say a word also about Halldór Laxness' book, Independent People, which you do mention in the text of your book. And it's if people are familiar at all with Iceland, it might be because of that book.
Yes, Halldór Laxness was really Iceland's most famous writer. He won the Nobel Prize in 1955. Independent People was published in America in an English translation in 1946, and it became a big bestseller. It was a Book of the Month Club bestseller. However, it was not reissued, and neither were any of his other novels for over 50 years. And there's evidence that has emerged, and I can't really speak to the veracity of it at this point because it's been newly obtained under the Freedom of Information Act. But there is some evidence and suspicion that Laxness was blacklisted because he was a communist. Although he later toned it down and became a socialist, he was very concerned with the plight of working people all over the world. And so the CIA and the FBI really put the lid on his work in this country. And so many people have really never heard of this Nobel Prize winner and his wonderful novels. And in 1997, they reissued Independent People and then began reissuing the rest of his novels. And I really encourage people to read the work of Halldór Laxness because it will take you into another world, sometimes a world that's grim and gritty and hard, but he's also very sardonic and funny.
Yes. And the book never – I mean, there were always readers. People found the book,
yes,
even though it wasn't in print, and kept the book alive. And so that now it's people are buying it again and talking about it and reading it.
Jane Smiley says, I can't imagine any greater delight than coming to Independent People for the first time. Jane Smiley is one of my favorite writers and somebody who has studied the Norse sagas extensively.
Yes. Did she write a book about Iceland?
She wrote a book called The Greenlanders.
The Greenlanders. Oh, you must be – people always get the two islands.
They
confused.
Do.
You must be so tired of that. Sorry about that. But it is a very, very interesting book.
It's a very interesting book. And she really has – you know, her ability to write in different genres and different styles is amazing.
It is.
And that book, she writes in the actual saga style.
Yes.
Which when I first read it, you know, my mother was trying to get me to read the sagas and I found them very difficult to get into. It was so terse and – I couldn't understand what people were thinking or feeling or why they were doing what they were doing. And my mother explained to me that that was the style that you were expected to write in because the sagas were considered history. These were not novels. Mm-hmm. They were considered historical accounts. Mm-hmm. And so you wouldn't write down what you imagined was in somebody's head. You would write down what that person said or did. Mm-hmm. And from that, people would infer what they would. And there's some very strong women in the sagas as well as a lot of the strong male Viking characters.
Excellent.
And once you learn how to read the sagas, they become very enchanting and bring you into a completely different world. Mm.
Christina, you've given us a wonderful background from which to read your exciting and beautifully written novel, The Tricking of Freya. And I thank you so much for coming in and taking the time. It's a good read. It's a page-turner. You know, I read far into the night when I was reading it for the first time. But in addition to that, there are memorable characters and a great deal of history and appreciation for people about whom we know so little. And thanks to you, we know more and we're interested in finding out more. Christina, people are going to want to look for you on the internet. Can you give us some guidance about where to find you there?
Sure. I think the best place to start is my website, which is www.christinasunley.com. You'll find a lot of information there about the book and how I came to write it, as well as my blog, which is called Confessions of a Debut Novelist, and tracks some of my experiences in writing the book, which took about 8 years, and also in publishing and going on a book tour. And I'm also on Facebook.
Okay.
I'm especially hopeful that readers in Sonoma County are going to begin reading my book because I wrote a lot of this book while I was living in Sonoma County. Strange as it may seem, I was in the beautiful farmlands of Petaluma looking out the window while I was writing about much of this Icelandic landscape.
Thanks for helping us tell people about your book.
Thank you so much, Rosemary.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. You've been listening to A Novel Idea. Our guest this evening was Christina Sunley, and we talked about her book, The Tricking of Freya. Thanks also to Suzanne Lang, who produces the show. Thanks to everybody who helps us get Novel Idea on the air. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. And remember, there's no such thing as too many books.